asked me once, what was in room IOI? I told you that you knew the answer already. Everyone knows it. The thing that is in room IOI is... information on intelligence.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to this March the 3rd, 2011 show of Room IOI. My name is Estra, and you're listening to Hackerspace's Signal. Unfortunately, Room IOI's own senior Breaking Bad News correspondent Morgan Merkibwar, aka Headhunter, is out of town this week. However, this fine night we'll be chatting with two other very excellent people, neighborly I'd even say, namely that's Mr. Pepe Zawodzki, Vienna-based Mac sysadmin, and I guess Mac guru I should say. Plus we'll be hearing some even more secretive updates from our old friend Chris John Riley later tonight. First off though, I'm gonna go play you a little music to get you in the right mood. It's a track I just recently got to know when I became the hugest fan ever of a poor yet unreasonably hard LA DJ, Count Ninjala, whose unreasonably hard mixes you can find and grab on SoundCloud.com, by the way. This, however, is LA-based DJ Mr. Skeleton featuring Behave, and the name of the track is Radio Old TV. Enjoy!
Fintech istoric n-aduce aminte că frații în veci vor fi frați, bătrân ca unirea.
Gunfire. The Pope is shot.
Come on, guys! You can't shoot that without hitting your pal here!
Help!
Wabak, 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 w
flames of hell consume him forever.
In other words, a Ram Jam.
Here they come.
That's a nice tune.
Oh, yes, that's a very good tune.
Don't make any noise when the music's playing. I don't like any noise when the music's playing.
Welcome back, everyone. This is Ruma UI, and our guest tonight is Pepi Zawadzki, aka Mac Lemon, a Vienna based sysadmin, as I mentioned before. Hi, Pepi.
Hi, Astra.
As a lot of you people out there might have guessed already, we'll be talking about Mac OS X's new version, Lion. I think by now they're running out of big cat's names. Could this be Pepi?
Yeah, definitely. There's none left anymore, I think, from a biological point of view.
So, I hear you've been a sysadmin for quite a while, but not for all your life. Is this true?
Yeah, it's been like 15 years or something like that now that I've done Mac sysadministration from the early days in system 6.7. Like, and of course Mac OS X now.
That's quite a while already. So for how long have you been, let's say, in charge of early reviewing or bug reporting for Apple?
Well, bug reporting is simply an issue of if you're registered as a developer with Apple, you can do bug reporting. For Mac OS X seeding access, which is a separate part, I've been since 10.5 Leopard.
Is that also something you can apply for, or?
Yeah, usually you can apply for and get ignored. Most of the time, Apple picks their seeders.
So how did you get up to this point? Just for those of the listeners that might be interested in not only just bug reporting of already of systems that are already out there, but probably of early review issues.
Well, it's become a lot easier since you can now get the Mac Developer Program for $99, and you get access to the Mac OS X seeding software. So if you just want to have a glimpse at Lion and test your applications with it or your systems, just become an Apple developer, pay your fee, and
gotcha.
you can just download it.
Now, from a different standpoint, are these bug reports that you file, do you have the any idea of how seriously they're being taken?
Well, the Apple bug reporting system is called Radar, and Apple lives and breathes out of Radar. Everything that is not in Radar as a bug report or as a filed issue, it doesn't exist for Apple at all. So
if something is in Radar, like if you submit a bug, Do you feel like they respond very quickly?
It depends on the bug. You can do your own classification, and from the depending on that, you get a quick response or a more lax response, probably. But you definitely get a response for each and every bug you file. And if it's only, yeah, it's a duplicate, somebody else has filed it, and this is the original tracking number, we're all of it.
Gotcha. So back to OS X Lion, which I believe will be released this summer. I've been seeing your tweets recently on, it was more of a rage, I think, about some graphical interface. Could we call them bugs?
Yeah, of course you can call them bugs. So.
What has changed?
I mean, Apple's been a role model for designing good user interface, and it's part of the success of Mac OS X is definitely the user interface, and even more so with iOS and the iPhone, iPad, and all those shiny devices. They're bringing a lot of stuff they've learned from the iPad back to Mac OS X, and this is part of the problem, because Apple's done a great job in teaching developers that your finger is not a mouse, and that a touch-based interface has some very different paradigms than a keyboard and mouse and click interface. And developers had to learn a lot to accommodate these changes in their user interfaces they design. And Apple has now started to bring back some stuff they've introduced with iOS into macOS X, and it's a problem because they don't respect their own human interface guides there. Like,
rather overestimate the usage of the trackpad.
Not necessarily that, but things that are very valid for a touch device with very limited screen real estate or direct interaction through touching things on screen, you directly touch on the object you want to interact with, that does not apply to a trackpad or mouse input.
Could you probably give us an example of this user interface experience that they want to bring in with Lion?
Application. Yeah, no, it's not even a specific application. It's system-wide. The main problem is scrolling and scroll bars at the moment, I think. Because from iOS, if you ever had an iPhone in your hand, you know, there are no scroll bars. Of course, you couldn't touch them. They would be too tiny. There's no screen space to display a scroll bar all the time. But somehow you need to tell the user there's more content and how much content he's currently seeing from what is there, like a long web page. Mm. And as soon as you start scrolling or flicking a page with your finger on an iPhone, a scroll bar appears and shows you where you are and how much content you're seeing, and it fades away when the content stops moving. This is, of course, because there's very limited screen space and you cannot accommodate for a permanent scroll bar there.
Sure.
But this is not the case on Mac OS X with a huge display in comparison to an iPhone. There is space to always have this information on screen. And when you start now having more or less, depending on what input devices your system has, you start seeing scroll bars or not. There's no scroll arrows anymore. They're rarely needed today because most people use a mouse with a scroll wheel or a trackpad where you can scroll with two fingers. But it's still valuable information, like where am I in this document and how much of the document am I seeing. So this is quite an issue, I think, because the default settings are just get rid of them, which is not okay, I think. And another problem is, you probably know the bounce effect from iOS when you reach the edge of content.
Sure.
The system bounces your page a little to tell you, okay, I understood you wanted to go there. I've recognized your touch movement or your gesture. But there is nothing more to see. And this is quite a gesture and a response from the operating system that everybody instinctively understands. And they started to put that into Mac OS X. So every time you, probably even by accident, start scrolling somewhere, every content starts bouncing around. And I think this is especially bad when the content you have is already 100% shown on screen. So there is nothing, nowhere to scroll to. And yet it tells you, oh yeah, I'm start bouncing this around.
All right.
So every time you scroll up on a web page and reach the upper edge, it takes you a second until you can further interact with the page or start reading again because it starts bouncing around. This is, yeah, quite annoying.
Hmm. Well, I've just briefly looked through the Apple.com page on Lion. They announced quite a number of new features, and really some of them remind of the iOS very much. They're advertising a lot of full screen apps that are to be seen as full screen with just one click of one special character combination. There's also the Mac App Store, which I think is pretty much the same as the iTunes Store probably, or iTunes App Store. And Launchpad, what exactly can you get out of Launchpad?
Yeah, well, you correctly recognize they're taking a lot of inspiration from iOS and putting it on the Mac. The Mac App Store is already available if you have macOS 10, 10.6.6 or probably a later version. You can already use the Mac App Store. There's quite a bunch of applications there. It's basically very, very similar to the iOS App Store that you already know from iTunes, but it's a separate application. Many people are very happy that Apple didn't put that into iTunes OS as well. Yeah, Launchpad is an attempt to make launching applications a little easier or get a better overview of the applications that you have installed on your system.
So basically it shows you every application that you would find in your application folder, is that correct?
It's more or less that, yeah. All the applications from your applications folder, your personal applications folder in your home directory, utilities and developer tools show up there. And you can sort them and put them into something like folders, just like on the iPad. It just works the same, or on the iPhone. Like your home screens on the iPhone, they really work exactly the same.
Right. Well, there's probably not much discussion on whether this is useful or not, because I think it's a very personal approach you might have to that. Another thing that shows you, gives you a great overview on screen, is something called Mission Control. So what exactly does Mission Control do?
Well, Mission Control is a unification of already existing features in macOS X. It's basically Spaces, which is Apple's implementation of virtual desktops, known for a very, very long time. Different Unix flavors. It also incorporates Exposé, which gives you a quick overview of all the open windows that your applications have on screen, and depending on what you want, you can get all the windows from a single application or from all applications, and you can also gain very quick access to your desktop. It's nothing really special these days anymore. Most operating systems or window managing software offers similar features by now.
So basically an overview of what's running on your Mac.
Yeah, it's basically get the big picture of what you're working with at the moment. And Mission Control tries to unify all that into one single huge piece of overview screen. I'm not quite sure if that will work out fine for all persons, because it's a very different approach. They have started to correct a few issues they introduced with 10.6, especially in the Exposé category there. We'll see how that works out. I'm really annoyed by the Spaces implementation, because up until now you could have a very spatial layout for Spaces, like 3x2 spaces or 4x4, 3x3, in a rectangular manner, and now the new Spaces implementation is all linear side to side. So you're basically in a one-dimensional line moving your view over the spaces now.
Oh, I wasn't aware of that. That sounds so un-Mac OS X-ish to me.
Yeah, it's like home screens on your iPhone. They're side by side each other. And
again, moving in iPad direction, iOS direction.
Yeah, and I think it's a little too much to in the iOS direction there, because it does not necessarily apply to the user interface on a computer. I think it's not the best way to do it.
Well, there's a couple more things they introduced with this version, and now we're getting to the more interesting part as well. First of all, to all of our readers, listeners, of course, not readers, listeners, there is not many bugs you're actually allowed to disclose this way. Is this correct? At this point.
Yeah, well, as a developer or seed tester, you're under non-disclosure agreement, of course. And you may not talk about things that are not already published by Apple or probably somebody else, which is then regarded as public or common knowledge.
Okay, so we noted that.
Yeah.
Next feature on our list would be autosave. Sounds fancy.
Yeah, it's a very simple feature, actually. Many applications already do that on their own. It seems Apple is trying to get rid of the file system as a paradigm for the user. There's no file system on iOS visible for the user, and Launchpad basically gets rid of your applications folder. It just shows you all the applications that are there. And autosave, is some kind of approach for documents there as well.
So what is being autosaved?
It's basically the document that you have open, like every in seconds, the system saves the state of this document.
Could this be any document running in any application?
That's
like anything from terminal Vim to a Photoshop image.
I think it's limited to GUI applications. So everything running in your terminal, you still have control over what you're saving and. You can happily type colon Q bang and get rid of all your changes. It's a feature that applications explicitly have to support. It's quite easy to implement in your existing applications. And yeah, it's also tied in with the file system as well.
So how long are things being autosaved? Let's say you're working on a document for maybe an hour or maybe 5.
That's something that is not really well known to this at this point in time. I've played around a little with like TextEdit, for example, which already does support this feature. It's not really clear when it does autosave or in which intervals it does that and for how long these different versions are kept. That is still to be discovered, I think.
Okay. So I think what I read on the Lion page on Apple.com is something like a document is being automatically locked after 2 weeks or something. Is that a change that should raise awareness from a security point of view?
Yeah, well, if you start forensically digging into the file system, you probably have a lot of interesting stuff to find there because every application that does support autosave also supports a new feature called versions, which is basically an automatically versioning file system feature. It's not really that, but
you can compare it with Git or Mercurial or.
It's not really a versioning system with diffing and commit messages, but. Every application that supports autosave automatically does versions of its documents. I don't know yet where exactly and how these versions are saved, and that what I know I may not disclose at the moment. But yeah, you can probably find former versions of a document in the file system, like ones that are not yet censored or have things blacked out before publication. As far as I can tell, these versions do not travel with the document. So if you email a document to somebody else, they don't automatically get all the versions in all the history of the document itself as well.
Gotcha. Are these two autosave and versions add-ons that you could also turn off?
I don't think so. If an application does support this, it will do it, and if it does not support it, it won't. Well, there's no preference to set, at least I haven't discovered it yet.
Oh, I see. Well, something that probably is tied into this very much as well is what they call resume. So what's that about?
It's also something they gained from iOS, which is that an application primarily takes care of saving its own state all the time. If you leave an application on iOS, you basically return to that same view and page and content. At least you should. In most cases, you actually are. So an application that does autosave also will probably resume support the resume feature, which means you can log out of your computer or even restart it. And all applications that support resume will automatically go back to the state when you left them, which is open all the documents that you had open and position all the windows where you had them and all that stuff.
I could see this from probably two standpoints. Mac does not bring out security updates in a very strict, timely manner, right? There's a new security update maybe every 2 or 3 months or something, but not on a specific time. So probably you would want to wait with rebooting your computer to get to use this new kernel for a while because of all the things that you have open right now. And not being able to return to the exact state. So from that point of view, it may be a very well-designed feature. You can just apply these security patches and then reboot and be right back to where you were.
Yeah, sure. It definitely will help to reduce the intrusion into your working workflow caused by a reboot that's necessary for this or that update. The sad thing is not every application will support this feature from day one. So it will be quite some time until all the applications or most of the applications will support resume. A different point of view would be that some people see a reboot or a logout as some kind of cleanup. So to get rid of all the state they had and start with a fresh clean slate. Unfortunately, this is optional, so you can tell the system to restore state after a reboot or to just, start with a clean login.
Any other implications you probably see with these last three mentioned changes in the operating system? That you actually can report?
Well, as you said, I really hope it does help to lower the bar and get more people to get their patches and updates and actually install them and not click this not now button for like 2 years in a row and never have an update installed. It's not that complex anymore to do this stuff, yet so many people refuse to do it and I still have a problem understanding why. And maybe that is an issue with getting your state back and continuing where you left. So I hope this will help make Macs a little safer in this world. Yeah, we'll see if it really catches on.
Okay, another new, freshly introduced feature is AirDrop. It's about sending files on your local network, as I understand it. Does this in any way correspond to Bonjour?
It's actually, from how I understand it at the moment, it's not actually tied to your local network, like your local broadcast domain. It's actually your physical proximity of your Wi-Fi network, which means Yeah, it surely works over the local network and probably not only over Wi-Fi, but Ethernet as well. I haven't yet had a chance to play around with it a lot. But what I think it also does is that you can start sharing files and send them to somebody without having a hotspot or actually being associated with a network. Something like an ad hoc network, which does not need an ad hoc setup, and your Wi-Fi card basically switches between the own ad hoc broadcasting network and the normal base station it's associated with.
Interesting and scary at the same time, I think.
Yeah, probably. There might be some IPv6 introduced as well, so might also help to send files to some arbitrary location or person. We'll see how that evolves. I cannot tell too much about this at the moment yet.
Right. Probably we should have you in for an update at some point when it's actually out. I think one of the biggest features that is going to be introduced with OS X Lion is the new file vault. So file vault, which previously would have encrypted your home directory, it's now using XTS AS128, and it also supports full disk encryption. Is that a default feature?
It's a default feature. It's not turned on by default. But actually, when you install Lion, the welcome assistant that greets you will actually allow you to set it up from the second you install the system, and allow you to start encrypting your hard drive even before you're logged into the system the first time. So yeah, you can have proper real full disk encryption with pre-boot authentication now.
So may I ask, did you use, you as a proper Mac user, only using Macs, did you use FileVault before, or did you also use full disk encryption that was not well provided by Apple initially?
To be honest, I haven't used full disk encryption because the only product available there is PGP Enterprise, which has recently been bought by Symantec. So that lost the last bit of trust in this system with me. There haven't been any other full disk encryption solutions, sadly, on the Mac up until now, or up until this coming summer. FileVault itself does not have a really successful history. Started with 10.5, where they basically put your whole home folder in a monolithic image file, like a sparse image, that would grow over time, and it would not work with Time Machine, Apple's backup solution. So you had to log out to actually do a backup of your home folder, which was a really terrible solution. And it was also prone to a lot of problems, like should your Mac crash, the image file could get damaged and you won't be able to log in again because the image file would not mount and all that stuff. They did solve a lot of this with 10.6, where it's now using a sparse bundle, which is a lot more robust and also working a lot better. Also supports AS256 now. And yeah, but still left the problem with having like your temporary folder unencrypted, because that would not reside in your home folder. So it was a, really not that well thought through solution. And I definitely will use full disk encryption with Lion once it comes out, because that is the proper way to do it.
And so with Lion, now, is AES256 an option as well, or are you bound to the 128 bits?
With full disk encryption, I guess it's 128, and there's nothing I've found to change that yet. If you want to use like encrypted disk images, like similar to what you can do with TrueCrypt, you can have an optional encryption of AES256 as well.
So how about your backups? Would your backup be encrypted by default as well?
Again, it's not the default, but it's a very prominent option in Time Machine by now, with Lion, yeah. In 10.6, you have to jump through a lot of hoops to make your backups with Time Machine encrypted. With Lion, that is a default option. It's not set as the default to encrypt backups, but it's just a checkbox that you do when you set up your Time Machine backup. So that probably will help a lot as well to make it easier for people to safeguard the data and their backups.
So would File Vault also include any other external devices that you could plug into your Mac?
Yes, you can use it with external hard drives, like, or surplus hard drives as well, yeah, of course. It might not be that easy to set it up there, but it's possible, yeah.
Okay. I think we're pretty much through all the features that are being advertised on the Mac page. As a roundup, what would you say? Where is Apple going with this release?
Well, they're going the consumer way, I think. They're trying very hard to make it easier to use, to make it more like iOS, to bring desktop computing more to a natural approach for the persons using the computers. On the other hand, they're still very dedicated to the underlying Unix stuff, and they're pretty much updating that as well. I don't know how far Apple is doing with security updates and getting up to speed there. They really need to improve their response times in releasing updates. They haven't gone to patch dates like Adobe or Microsoft or other large manufacturers. Apple's still not there doing this. But at least on the security side, Apple does respond to bugs filed on Radar that you classify as security relevant. You definitely get a timely response there. And it's getting better there, so I hope, yeah, this will be good.
So as a very last question, OS X Lion is also coming out as a server version. Now, as a sysadmin, are you looking forward to this release as well?
Well, of course, it's a lot of new toys to play with. up until now, Apple had separate client and server releases. They're now unifying that, and server tools and the services are now basically an optional installer package on the install medium, which might be a USB stick or just a digital download, like they did with the beta versions at the moment. I haven't yet played around with the server part yet. There's, I guess, a lot to discover how they move away from a dedicated server system to an integrated server system, like that everybody can install without having to pay like $500. And you still have the option to just install the stuff and, yeah, basically use it as a desktop system, which wasn't really a recommended way of using macOS 10 server up until now. Like using macOS 10 server on a laptop on the go is just, don't do it. It's not really working well. It's meant to be static on a system.
Okay, well, thank you so very much for your time, Peppy. If anyone might have any questions probably or wants to read your updates on the rage about OS X Lion, where would they find that?
Well, yeah, most of my rants go out on Twitter for everyone to see. So you can just follow at MacLemon to see what I have to say about Lion or other Mac-related or iOS-related stuff. Many of my tweets are in English and some are in German, so bear with me. You can also send me an email to peppy@maclemon.com, .at. Sorry, I don't have the com for that one.
Okay, awesome. Thanks so much again for your time. And we will be hearing a bit of music again, so please hold. Bye,
Peppy. Thanks for having me. Bye. Oh, shit.
Once more time and long ago, I saw my baby, whoa. You dance with another man, so I bet she's got it.
Go.
Well, it was my gun and I first my skin. I shot her in the head. Well, the cops came around, they struck me sound. And this is what they said. Well, they said, put down your weapon, son. Keep your hands up in the air. Now wave the two and thrown about. Your toes like six hair. The sun said, put down your heater, son. We don't want to have to go to bed. Now twist and turn, get on the floor. Act like we were shooting your bed. Have you any last words to say? And I said,
Mr. Skeleton, called Pack and Hass, again with DJ Behave, which is also freely available on soundcloud.com/Mr_Skeleton if you're interested. But I think I'll also link to his account on the wiki page. Right now with me, I have Christian Riley. For those of our listeners that have tuned in for the past couple of months as well, you might already be familiar with his name because he gave an excellent interview for us. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Thanks very much for accepting me back on. I thought after my last interview, no one would ever want to invite me back on again.
There is a very specific reason we have you on today. Pretty much as secretive as our last guest, Peppy, you'll be talking about something happening in Vienna this June.
Yes, that's right. We've been working in the background on what will now, for the meantime, be referred to as Super Secret Con, because we're going through the process of finalizing some details, shall we say, before we can release any more details about what the conference is going to be. But we wanted to kind of put the word out there that we are going to be running a conference in June. The exact date is 18th. Saturday, the 18th of June.
Which is also the finishing date or the day after the last day of the first conference, right?
Yeah, it's conveniently timed. Who'd have thought to be the day after the first conference finishes in Vienna? So it's conveniently planned. Anyone else think that we actually kind of planned it to be that day? But,
who would think such a thing?
Who would think such a thing? No one. The idea is to kind of tag on an open, community-driven, free event for people who've either been attending first and they want to kind of mingle with some people in Austria and some people from various different countries who will be attending the conference. And obviously people in Austria who want to maybe meet some of the people who were at the first conference as well. So we're going to put something together that's free and open for everyone.
So how about the main topic for this conference, for Super Secret Con?
Obviously we're looking at a security conference, so we're going to be covering hopefully an equal number of attack and defense related topics. I mean, there's been a lot of focus on attack stuff, so I'd really like to kind of work in some defensive talks, but it's all dependent on what people come up with. It's community driven, so if people want to talk about Perl scripting, then that's what we'll talk about. It's we'll pull together as many people in the call for papers as we can, and then we'll put it open to the community and let the people who will be attending vote on what they want to see, because after all, they're the important thing. I mean, we're just the ones who come up with the room and stick a projector in it and say, here you go, we're having a conference. The people who actually turn up are the important people.
Sounds excellent. So we don't really have a CFP yet, as I understand it. But if people would be interested in getting notified first, as soon as a CFP is up, or as more details about Super Secret Con, as well as including the conference name, would like to be notified, could they probably send a mail somewhere?
Yeah, well, I set up an email address for people to mail through if they want some more information. And obviously, as soon as it's available, I'll reply to the emails for anyone who's interested, as well as putting up some information on my blog and on Twitter as well, so that people are aware of what's going on. If they send a mail through to supersecretcon@c22.cc, and I'll get back to them with some information on the call for paper and the conference in general as soon as we're able to talk about it.
Excellent. Just for those who are not familiar with you right now, your blog is available on which address?
Blog.c22.cc.
Awesome. And your Twitter account is?
At Chris John Riley.
Excellent. Well, do we have anything more to say about this con? It's going to be June. It's hopefully going to be very sunny and warm. And Vienna is an excellent destination, I think, for making a short trip to or doing a holiday. If you're in town for first, or if you're just going to be available for the weekend in Vienna, the weekend of the 18th of June, then probably this is the place you want to be at.
Definitely. And also keep your eyes open.
You want to be talking at.
Yeah, definitely. Brush up your talks. I mean, we're going to be hopefully coming up with a number of 30-minute or 60-minute talks, depending on, you know, what people want to do. And we'll try and throw in some shorter talks as well, kind of like 15-minute talks as well. So it's only going to be a single day, so we're trying to get as much out of the day as we possibly can.
But I guess there's also going to be room for more private chatter at the same time.
Well, that's what these small conferences are like. It's more about the community and interacting with other people than it is about kind of seeing someone who's talked at five or six other conferences. I hope some people who haven't been giving talks at thousands of other conferences step forward and really use this as a launching platform for them to speak for the first time or gain more experience in talking.
Well, with that, actually, I am going to move onwards to a new series on this channel, on the showroom IOI, which is the Reciting Man Pages series. Unfortunately, Signal's senior command line foo correspondent, Michael Prokop, aka Mika, is not available tonight, because otherwise he would have been reciting this. Now you have to stick with me. Basically, I'm going to read you an interesting man page. This is what the series is all about. And this time around, this is about the tool called APG, available for Linux as well as for Mac. APG standing for a random password generator. So the description of the tool goes like this. APG generates several random passwords. It uses several password generation algorithms, currently two, and a built-in pseudo random number generator. Default algorithm is pronounceable password generation algorithm designed by Mori Gasser and described in a random word generator for pronounceable passwords on the National Technical Information Service ADA 017676. The original paper is very old and had never been put online, so I have to use NIST implementation described in FIPS 181. Another algorithm is Simple Random Character Generation Algorithm, but it uses four user-defined symbol sets to produce random passwords. It means that user can choose type of symbols that should appear in password. Symbol sets are numeric symbol set, 0 to 9, capital letter symbol set, A to Z, small letters symbol set, also A to Z, and special symbols set, which is like hash, at sign, hashbang, whatever. Built-in pseudo random number generator is an implementation of algorithm described in Appendix C of ANSI X9.17 or RFC 1750, with exception that it used CAS or SHA-1 instead of triple DES. It uses local time with precision of microseconds, see get time of day 2, and dev random if available to produce initial random seed. APG also have capability to check generated password quality using dictionary. You can use this ability if you specify command line options /r dictfile or -b filter name, where dictfile is the dictionary file name and filter name is the name of Bloom filter file. In that dictionary, you may place words, one per line, that should not appear as generated passwords, for example, usernames, common words, etc. You even can use one of the dictionaries that come with dictionary password crackers. Bloom filter file should be created with apgbfm, one utility, included in APG distribution. In future releases, I plan to implement some other techniques to check passwords, like pattern check, just to make life easier. Now we get to the options. Password generation mode options. -A algorithm. Use algorithm for password generation. 0 or default pronounceable password generation. 1 random character password generation. -N num of pass. Generate num of pass number of passwords. Default is 6. -M min pass length. Generate password with minimum length, min pass length. If min pass length is greater than max pass length, the max pass length equals min pass length. Default minimum password length is 8. -X, max password length. Generate password with maximum length, max password length. Default maximum password length is 10. -M, mode. Mode is a text string consisting of characters capital S, S, capital N, N, capital C, C, capital L, L, where capital S. Generator must use special symbol set for every generated password. S. Generator should use special symbol set for password generation. Capital N. Generator must use numeral symbol set for every generated password. N. Generator should use numeral symbol set for password generation. Capital C. Generator must use capital symbol set for every generated password. C. Generator should use capital symbol set for password generation. Capital L. Generator must use small letter symbol set for every generated password, always present if pronounceable password generation algorithm is used. L. Generator should use small letter symbol set for password generation. Mode cannot be more than 4 characters in length. Note. Usage of capital L, capital M, capital N, capital C will slow down password generation process. Examples. -M, SNCL, or -M, capital S, capital N, capital C, capital L, or -M, capital C, N. -E, char string. Exclude characters in char string from password generation process. In pronounceable password generation mode, you cannot exclude small letters. To include special symbols that can be recognized by shell, like apostrophe, quotes, dollar sign, etc., in char string, use the backslash versions. I'm going to spare you these examples. I'm going to spare you even more examples. And then we get to the password quality control options, like -r for dictfile, -b for filter file, as we already mentioned, -p for the min substring length, This option tells APG to check every substring of the generated password for appearance in filter file. If any of such substrings would be found in the filter file, then generated password would be rejected and APG will generate another one, and so on and so forth. Pseudo-random-number-generator-options -s ask user for random sequence for password generation. -c clseed use clseed as a random seed for password generation. I use it when I have to generate passwords in a shell script. Password output options. -d do not use any delimiters between generated passwords. I use it when I have to generate passwords in a shell script. -y print generated passwords and encrypted passwords. See mancrypt tree. -q quiet mode. Do not print warnings. -l spell generated passwords. Useful when you want to regenerate a password by telephone. Warning. Think twice before you read your password by telephone. -t print pronunciation for generated pronounceable password. -h print help information and exit. -v print version information and exit. Default options are quite many. This is APG-A0, as mentioned before, -M-SNCL, -N6-X10-M8. This is new stuff. If you want to generate really secure passwords, you should use option-S. To simplify APG usage, you can write a small shell script. I'm going to spare you this example as well. Exit code, diagnostics, files, bugs, see also the general stuff you find in the man page. Also, there's no box, of course. And the author of this very handy tool is called Adel I. Mirzaharov. The project homepage can be found at www.abdel.nursa.kz/apg. The automated password generator brought to you, theoretically, by Signal senior command line foo correspondent Mikhail Prokop. If you have any idea of a new man page that should be resided, which is also short and also handy and probably not well known, but you really like to use it in everyday life, as I do, and probably as you do if you're a sysman, then I would really encourage you to mail this to me at roomioi@hackerspaces.org. So much for that. Let's call it a day. Chris, you still there?
Yeah, still here.
Excellent. Then I would like to say thank you for your attendance again on Room IOI.
No problem. Thank you very much for having me on.
It was a pleasure. And we're going to, of course, announce any more details as soon as they're available and not under a non-disclosure agreement anymore. Thanks, Chris, and good night. And good night to all of our listeners.
Good night.
Information on intelligence.